tonight a brief overview of the book of Esther. You cannot look at the book without appreciating the fact that God protects His people. Probably the main lesson of the book. The title of this book, of course, bears the name of the leading character in the book, a lovely Jewish maiden who became the queen of Persia. The name Esther is apparently derived from the Persian word for star. Esther's Hebrew name, Hadassah, means myrtle. The author of the book, the date of the writing, are unknown. Of course, you always have the speculation and guesses about who wrote a book where the writer's not named in the book. We just don't know that information. A little bit of the historical setting. The 12 books in the Old Testament, Joshua through Esther, covered a period of time of about 1,000 years from Israel's entrance into the Promised Land in 1450 B.C. to the end of what's known as the Old Testament period of history, about 432 B.C. The last three books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, cover the last of the 12 divisions of the Old Testament history known as the post-exile period or after the exile, return of the remnant of the Jews from Babylonian captivity. After the recording of the events in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, it really would be about 400 years before sacred history was resumed again in the coming of the Lord. 536 B.C., you recall, the first remnant of about 50,000 returned from captivity led by Zerubbabel. Restoration of the temple was begun. It was discontinued after 2 years. About 520 to 516 B.C., we have prophecies from Haggai and Zechariah encouraging the completion of the temple, which is completed in the year 516 B.C. 578 B.C. is about the time that Esther becomes queen of Persia. In 458 B.C., Ezra leads the second group of less than 2,000 from Babylon to Jerusalem with his spiritual and moral reforms, and then the history continues after that, but placing Ezra in that scheme of history is what we're noting there by looking at the historical setting. Only a remnant of the Jews returned to Jerusalem from captivity, about 50,000, while the majority, most of them who were born in captivity, remained in Babylon. They had become pretty much settled there, made the choice to remain there, and that is where they became the object of Haman's malice, one of the characters in the book. Ahasuerus, in chapter 1 and verse 1, is really considered to be another name for Xerxes the Great, who ruled Persia from 486 to 465 B.C. The great feast in the third year of his reign that you can read about, chapter 1, beginning of verse 3, may have been in preparation for his somewhat ill-fated military adventure against the Greeks, opposing the Greeks. And if so, the events of the sixth and seventh years of his reign, which are described somewhat in chapter 2, verse 12 and 16, would have taken place after his defeat. The story of Esther takes place at Susa, the winter residence of the Persian kings. We know that from history. It's about 200 miles east of Babylon. The month Adar in chapter 3 and verse 7 corresponds to about our March or April. The Feast of Purim, which is mentioned in the book, is probably one of the most joyous Jewish religious celebrations that even survives to this day. During that celebration of the Jewish people, the book of Esther is read, And in some synagogues, noisemakers are given to children. Can you imagine if we handed out noisemakers to some of our children here? When the name of Haman is read, people hiss and boo. But when the name of Esther or Mordecai is read, people shout and spin these noisemakers in celebration for their victory. Principal characters in the book. The Persian king, as we mentioned before, is identified as Xerxes the Great of historical fame, who with an army of about 5 million defeated the Greeks at Thermopylae in 481 B.C., if you remember from your ancient history class in high school or college, or personal reading of your own about history. What a spectacular victory that was, only to suffer defeat about a year later. He lost to the Greeks also at a sea battle, the Battle of Salamis. And likely it was on his return from these defeats that he married Esther. Vashti is another character in the book. The Persian king's queen. At the beginning of the book, when we open the book and first read about his kingdom and his reign, he dethroned her when she refused his order to appear before him and his princes at what was evidently a drunken feast in chapter 1, verses 10 through 22. Mordecai is a character in the book, this courageous and godly Jew, relative of Esther, who brought up his orphaned cousin and remained her counselor even after she became queen. Esther, of course, is a character in the book, presented to us on the pages of God's Word as a very beautiful young Jewish, whom the Persian king chose above all the maidens of succession to Vashti. The king, not knowing at the time, of course, that she was a Hebrew. You can see that in the text pretty clearly. Haman is a central character in the book. He's a wicked enemy of the Jews, plotted to destroy them after the king of Persia set him above all the princes, and Mordecai refused to bow down to him, you recall. Key events can be seen in any outline of the book. This one is a simple outline taken from a study Bible that talks about the Jewish royal contacts in the first part of the book, where Esther replaces Vashti as queen, and how that happened, how that could happen in a situation where a Jewish maiden arose to such prominence in the government scheme of a heathen country. We have some information given to us about how Mordecai saves the king's life in chapter 2. Second section being the Jews were threatened, Haman's plot to destroy all the Jews, and the appeal by Mordecai and Esther, and then the Jews triumph in the end where Mordecai replaces Haman, and there is a great deliverance of the Jews, and how that all comes about in this country. It's a very interesting story, just two people who are interested in reading strange stories of governments and dealings, underdealings between people and how they work out in various situations. Main divisions of the book, and I never really thought about this before, at least that I can remember. I've seen various outlines with regard to the information contained in the book, as you have, but I had never really thought about it from the perspective of looking at it from the standpoint of there are three feasts in the book, one right after another, and all of the events seem to surround and have some important connection to those different feasts. The first part, the feast of the Persian king, events are connected with it in the first couple of chapters. It's a feast of 180 days for all the princes, we are told. A 7-day feast for all the people in Shushan, the palace. And Queen Vashti's noble refusal to attend to that, and the resulting, she's fired from being queen by her husband. Of course, at the prompting of other people, you know, you can't let this type of thing go on. So there's a selection made and enthronement of Esther in that first part, and Mordecai ends up saving the life of the king. And then there's another feast, and it's the feast of Esther in chapters 3 through 7, where the king's promotion of Haman and Mordecai's refusal to reverence him is spoken of. Haman becomes enraged and determines to destroy the Jews, and obtains the king's order authorizing the Persians to despoil and slay the Jews in one day, on an appointed day. And things happen that seem to be centered around this feast, just not to belabor that point. And then the Feast of Purim at the end, which is a celebratory thing, where the king further honors both Esther and Mordecai in chapter 8. At Esther's intercession, the king authorizes the Jews to defend themselves from the Persians, who are going to attempt to take their life on this one appointed day that's already been set in stone or set as a law that cannot be changed, the king's law. And upon the day of vengeance, the Jews slew their enemies more than 75,000, including 10 sons of Haman in chapter 9. And this Feast of Purim is instituted in chapter 9 as a great celebration. And Mordecai is exalted at the end of the book. Key words that you would think of when you read this book: providence, the providential care of God, the protection of God. Key verses, just to pick out a few, chapter 4 and verse 14. Whenever this is read, you might automatically make a connection to the book of Esther. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. And then in verse 16, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Esther's determination to speak to the king about a matter without his inviting her, which would have had bad circumstances for anyone who did such a thing as that. Chapter 8 and verse 17, maybe another key verse in the book. In each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. Three key ideas presented in those verses that I think are important for the book. Key phrase: for such a time as this. You know, God uses people in their times, in His time, in their circumstances to fit His scheme. And we see that wonderfully portrayed in this book. If we wanted to pick out a key chapter, maybe it would be chapter 8. Significant things happen in that chapter. According to the book of Esther, the Jews were saved from Haman's evil plot to destroy them by Esther's appeal on their behalf to the king of Persia, and his decree allowing them to defend themselves against their enemies. Chapter 8 records this event. Following Haman's death, hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai and the king's honoring of Mordecai. 8 and verse 16 says, for the Jews there was light and gladness, joy and honor. When we think about purpose or themes maybe for the book, a significant message of the book that kind of comes to mind and we like to reemphasize. It provides the only biblical portrait of many Jews who remained in Persia following the Babylonian captivity, rather than return to Palestine. Well, what's so significant about that? Well, you can see the providential hand of God working in the affairs of men to keep them from being utterly destroyed. God's guiding hand of providence, His protection on behalf of this people is very evident throughout this book, although God's name does not appear in the book. And some ruffians want to try to make something of that. It's not significant, I don't think. There's mention of fasting, but no reference to prayer. Yet the reality of God's providence is there in the book. It stands out. It's the central message of the book. The presence of God really permeates the text, whether the text mentions the name of God or not. Some people want to make a big deal about why does God's name not appear in this book? We ought to throw it out of the Bible because it doesn't belong there. Well, if you think about the historical setting of the book, it could be that the details that are recorded in this book were taken from civil records in Persia. And civil records in Persia wouldn't contain information specifically about Jehovah God or some insignificant group of people living in the country that people generally hated anyway. It wouldn't do that. They would be official documents relative to the proceedings of the Persian court. And if that's true, it could account for the reason why God's name is not mentioned. Some details given in the book are evidence of being taken from civil records, such as the names of Haman's sons, Esther being called the queen, and Mordecai called the Jew, and some particulars about the king. So even the absence of God's name in the book may really help us to understand the reality of the nature of providence. God's hand works in the affairs of men. God carries out His purpose. But He doesn't necessarily carry a banner with Him and have trumpets blowing saying, look here, my purpose is being carried out. Now, that's the providence of God. It works whether men realize it or not, whether they pay attention to it or not. God works in the affairs of men. Only the eye of faith sees that divine factor in human history. Now, what good is faith? Well, there's one good thing about faith right there. It relies on the providence of God, even when it's not just spelled out so that everyone can't possibly miss it. The appeal of the book is one that calls on us by what it says to have a great respect for the sovereignty of God and His supreme rule over all the nations, and His rule over our very lives. Respect the virtues exemplified by the heroes of the book, people who regarded God and wanted to serve God. Those things are the appeal of the book, I think. Maybe if we want to think about some lessons we could learn from a book like this, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road as far as what's in this book for me? What can I get out of this book that will help me live for God in the year 2012? Well, there are a few lessons that just kind of jump out at me. Maybe the modesty of Vashti is somewhat overlooked in the first part of the book, but I think it could be an example for all women, at the risk of losing everything, including her life, she refuses to obey an order of the king. Well, what was it about an order like that where someone could possibly even entertain the thought of disobeying the order of the king? What was it that was something that she felt so strongly about that she wanted to risk her own life to not do? You know, we have to give some thought to that in trying to understand from her perspective why she would refuse this order to parade herself in the circumstances that existed at the time she was called for, which appear to be that she's called on to parade herself before the lustful eyes of the king's drunken princes. Women today need to learn the beauty of holiness and the challenge of shamefastness and modesty in every way. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and 1 Peter 3. Was Vashti right to disobey her husband or not? Which? Well, maybe she was right, since it appears to be inappropriate in that society for women to mingle socially with men, which seems to be the indication from chapter 1 and verse 9. And since the king was drunk when he called for Vashti in 1 and verse 10, his request probably involved some impropriety and she was unwilling to do it. Some scholars believe that he commanded her to appear naked. The text doesn't say that, but it wouldn't be beyond what would be called on by people in that day, especially under those particular circumstances. But for whatever that's worth, and whatever the text says and what it does not say, the important thing to remember about that, however, is not whether Vashti was right or wrong, but rather that her dismissal from being queen providentially opened the door for Esther to become queen, putting her in a position where she could help her people and prevent them from being destroyed. That's the important thing, I think, about that. But there's some measure of modesty, however you would like to specify that, on the part of Vashti. That's important and good, I think. Another lesson that you see in this book, one of only two in the scriptures named for a female. One other thing that you see here is that the book in a very descriptive way, in a very graphic way, demonstrates what power and what influence a godly woman can have. You have to see that in the book. It's there on every page. And what a great lesson that can be for us today. The power and the influence of a godly female in this world is precious, to use a word from our lesson this morning. It is precious. It's a great lesson of the book. Another great lesson is always be ready for service. You know, if she had been a person who retreated from any kind of service because of shyness, because of fear, or whatever the situation may have been, it could have turned out differently, but she wasn't. And the service opportunity that came her way may not have been on her time schedule. It may not have been in her day planner to do what she did when she did it. But she was ready when the opportunity came to serve other people and to serve her God. And that's a great lesson in this book. Mordecai's unwavering dedication to God and his prayerful spirituality were not wasted one little bit on Esther. She was prepared for such a time as this, chapter 4 and verse 14. And at the risk of her life, she goes into the king, and her feeling about that, if I perish, I perish. But I have to do what is right. I have to do what is good. We can learn a great lesson from that if we adopt those same attitudes and are, as Timothy was instructed from Paul, ready for every good work, Titus 3 and verse 1. And then another significant lesson in the book, I think, out of the what I chose, four top lessons in the book. You have to see and appreciate the sovereignty of God. The book of Esther is one of the finest studies in the Bible about the providence of God. And it confirms everything that Paul wrote to Christians in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, for example. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Now, Esther confirms that very thing that Paul stated there. The events in the story also confirm Psalm 37, 12 and 13, which says this: "The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes at him with his teeth." Now get this: "The Lord laughs at him, for he sees his day is coming." Now that tells it, doesn't it? That tells just exactly, in a nutshell, what happened to those who plotted wickedness in the book. Babylon's ruler acknowledged in this principle that is stated by Daniel in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 29. There is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. And that's true. He rules by His might forever, Psalm 66 and verse 7. Confirmed in the book of Esther. God's will shall ultimately be done, as seen in His use of Esther and Mordecai to deliver His people, and also in the punishment of Haman and in Mordecai's charge to Esther in chapter 4 and verse 14. Four very great and valuable lessons in this short little book. A book that contains 10 chapters, 167 verses, approximately 5,637 words. Well, what does that mean? It means that if your average reading speed is 200 words a minute, you can read the book in 28 minutes. You know, we seem to be concerned about, well, how much time will it take me to do this or that? In planning things in our daily schedule, you could read this book in 28 minutes. 28 minutes, a relatively short period of time. And if you came away with two out of the four of these lessons that would help you in your life, would those 28 minutes be worth it? Yeah, sure, absolutely. Absolutely they would. The story of Esther tells how God kept His people from being annihilated. That's pretty incredible. If it were not for the courage of Esther, there might have been no nation through whom the Messiah would come. Esther and Mordecai paved the way for the work of Ezra and Nehemiah in the pages of the Old Testament. What a great book this is. And how valuable it should be even today to people who serve God, love God, appreciate God, and want to live for God and fit into God's purposes. Does that describe you, a person who loves God and wants to fit into God's purposes? I hope so. If you're in our assembly today and we can do anything to help you walk closer to God when you leave this building than when you first came in, any Christian here would do it. I know. We'll rally around you. We'll support you. We'll strengthen you. We'll pray with you, pray for you. We'll baptize you into Christ if that's your desire tonight. Whatever you need, we're here to serve you. And if we can serve you this very night, please come and let us know while we stand together and encourage you by singing this song.